You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, December 13th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Spencer Ackerman on drones, military detention, and our swan song in Iraq. Should be a wonderfully miserable conversation with Spencer Ackerman. Always lovely to have him on the program. Also on the show, our guy Ian from Occupy Baltimore. They were evicted this morning at 4 a.m. We'll find out If the Baltimore PD likes to tackle and rough up citizens' media, citizens' journalists, and protesters, like apparently the NYPD does. You know, because at one point, you got to start saying a duck is a duck is a duck. We'll also get updates on the port closings on the West Coast from yesterday. We'd love to talk to Jeff Smith, who was arrested in New York City yesterday in the World Financial Center as the police were protecting the, well, I guess, what were they protecting? The public space in the World Financial Center. They were protecting Brookfield from having their fifis hurt because people were, I guess, protesting Brookfield. I'm not quite sure what the police were protecting. You know, Jeff Smith, we all know how dangerous of a person he can be. I think he even had one of those tiny cameras that videotapes thing. Also on the program today, boo-hoo for the rich. It turns out new data suggests that in 2009, the extremely, horribly wealthy rich people were slightly less horribly, disgustingly rich for a brief moment in 2009. And we got to take a moment to just try and get a sense. Try and put yourself in their shoes, folks. If you can imagine, for just one moment, just one tiny fleeting moment, if you were making over, let's say, $300,000, $350,000 a year, just imagine your average income went down from 2007 to 2009 from $1.4 million. to $957,000. Just imagine what that would feel like. And then, of course, you know, imagine that a year passes and your income shoots back up to probably $1.2 million. And by 2011 rolls around, your average income is probably back to close to what it was. But just imagine how it felt for for that 1 year when your income dropped by nearly a half $1 million to just almost $1 million a year. And of course, your assets, you know, mostly stayed the same. You know, your house values, you know, your eight houses were no longer the value of like a normal person's five houses. must have been rough. But of course, New York Times wants to make it absolutely clear that we should all keep in mind that, you know, you chumps who have no homes or have no jobs or have a constant sense of economic insecurity, you're sort of not alone. I mean, you're not alone in the sense that there's a lot of other people like that, but you're also sort of not alone in that the rich had a year where they were like, oh, okay, everything's fine. Just wanted you to know. One of the stories we're going to be talking to Spencer Ackerman about is the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which passed in the Senate and supposedly be vetoed by President Obama. There's reason to doubt it, and we'll get to that in a moment. A sound clip from Senator Carl Levin. But before we do, I want to read this email from that we received at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Dear Majority Reporters, I would like to request that you stop providing the enormous amount of fresh and good content for free on a daily basis. Upon listening to your show with increasing regularity on the hourly daily commute to my university, Kuhn, Germany. What's up? We're getting a delivery. How's it going?
Okay, how are you?
I'm doing good. What do you think? Are you a little upset to find out that the top 1% back in 2007, their average pay was $1.4 million. In 2009, for a brief, horrible moment, their average pay was $957,000 a year. Now, you work for a delivery company. I'm not going to say which one because I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want to say
that. The biggest one in the world.
The biggest one in the world? Well, you people can guess what that is. Yeah. So give me your sense. You feel bad for these people?
I definitely don't feel bad, but what I do feel is the tax code needs to be changed for these individuals, that maybe they need to put in more than they're putting in at this time.
So higher taxes for the rich. Why are you such a class warrior? Why do you hate the rich? Why do you hate success?
I don't hate the rich because they should pay what the normal working class pays.
All right, that's a radical idea that the rich people should pay a tax rate about what the working class pays. But I don't know what they're teaching you in those the largest delivery company in the world. Apparently, they have these sort of communist training camps where they learn how to deliver packages. Anyways, upon listening to your show with increasing regularity on the hourly daily commute to my university, Köln, Germany, it's become near impossible to divert enough attention from your show to my train ride in order to catch the right stop. Yesterday was the last straw. Not only did I fail to get out of the train until its terminal stop, in a trance-esque state, I wandered about the train station and boarded the next best train that I saw, which did not happen to go to Kuhn. And all that because my mind was blasted by your free podcast with heaps and heaps of information and humor. Enough is enough, guys. I was an hour late yesterday already. What is next? You've become a severe hazard for the completion of my bachelor's degree. Sincerely, Tobias Stockler. Well, Tobias, there is a solution to your problem of getting your mind blown by our free podcast. Become a member. Pay for it on a daily basis. You guys in Germany making all of the rest of Europe is he a member? Oh, well, maybe he is a member already. Well, in which case, I salute you. You're not responsible for your country's loaning to, what? I'll give him a chauffeur. If he's a member, I will. Those German finance people, though, however, they loan all this money to Southern Europe so that Southern Europe can buy all their products, And then when the loans go south, they're like, oh. Does it remind you of anybody? All right. Jumping back to this National Defense Authorization Act. Let's listen to Carl Levin tell the Senate, anyways, that the language that allows for this act to detain American citizens was put in at the request of the administration. And when we get to Spencer Ackerman, he's going to tell us what gives. We'll be right back after the sound and then this musical break with Spencer Ackerman.
And I'm wondering whether the senator is familiar with the fact that the language which precluded the application of Section 1031 to American citizens was in the bill that we originally approved in the Armed Services Committee, and the administration asked us to remove the language which says that U.S. citizens and lawful residents would not be subject to this section. Is the senator familiar with the fact that it was the administration that asked us to remove the very language which we had in the bill which passed the committee, and that we removed it at the request of the administration that would have said that this determination would not apply to U.S. citizens and lawful residents? I'm just wondering, is the senator familiar with the fact that it was the administration which asked us to remove the very language?
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program, despite the fact that every time it comes on, it's a little bit depressing, because it tends to cover stuff that's slightly upsetting. Spencer Ackerman from Wired Magazine, The Danger Room is his blog, and of course you can also go to Attackerman. Is it Attackerman.com?
More noise.
What's that? Say it one more time. Sorry, we're a little bit slow on the
audio. Air horn noise.
What is Attackerman?
I'm sounding like an air horn slave.
Oh, okay. What is Attackerman? Is it Attackerman.com?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. So, all right, Spencer, let's start with the idea that our military, and you made a good point in your piece, the military does not have to detain American citizens for basically an open-ended commitment. But according to the National Defense Authorization Act, it appears that they can.
It's sort of like the best thing you can say about this bill from a civil liberties perspective is that the military doesn't have to lock you up forever.
Right.
It's just maybe they could, or it might be easier for them to do that. Carl Levin says the version of the bill that Senator McCain and the House Armed Services Committee leadership hammered out last night explicitly says U.S. citizens can't be locked up. However, it also says that basically every single possible civilian trial for terrorists in U.S. federal courts is donezo. That's over. Train has left the station on that. The military must become the venue for justice, and then the jailer for all terrorism cases.
So what happened in 93? What happened in 93 when we tried? When we tried the perpetrators of the attempted bombing of, or the bombing, I should say, of the World Trade Centers in 93, when we tried those people in New York, that can never happen again. Until we get a more thoughtful leadership in this country. Is that what you're saying?
It cannot happen. That would have to happen through military commissions. It cannot happen in civilian courts under the bill.
Wow. And now President Obama promised to veto this. Do you think he's going to?
Well, right now the White House is reviewing the bill. So it's sort of up in the air right now whether that veto threat still holds.
What do you think of the politics on this? I mean, do you think that, it seems to me the Obama administration is very keen to show their bona fides in terms of, I guess, infringing upon people's civil liberties and their musculature on security. So do you think that they are likely to the politics on this not in favor of, or would the politics on this lead you to believe that they're going to find, oh, we've reviewed the bill and it's really not as bad as we were afraid of, so we won't veto this?
I mean, the Obama administration never made a strong first principles argument that civilian trials for terrorism administer justice. They made a case all throughout their tenure that it's one tool among many to administer justice, and it never made a really clear case at all about why you want to use civilian trials for some terrorists, but military trials for others. So when that's the case, then you're sort of left in a bad position to run against the headwinds politically, which just say that they're terrorists, the military should handle them, period, which is definitely the safest place for any politician to get in. So if the Obama administration, you know,
particularly if you haven't made a principled argument.
Yeah, go ahead.
Particularly if you haven't made a principled argument to the contrary. I mean, if you say it's like, you know, there's no, it's always a case by case basis, it's very hard to make that argument against it.
That's right. And so,
well, I mean, I guess we wait and see, right? I mean, what is the timeline for something like this? Because it is an amendment. If I'm right, it's an amendment to a military spending bill, and you know, we got to get that cash going, right?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. The defense bills are weird things because there's one bill that authorizes Congress to spend the money, and then there's another bill that actually appropriates the money to it, but. You know, six of one, half a dozen of the other. The bills passed both houses. They're going to go back and revote, I think, this week on the new language that they came out with last night. And then it goes to Obama. So it's really up to the president now to say something about what the fate of this bill is going to be if he's going to stand firm and, you know, veto a defense bill.
Mm. All right. Let's move to Iraq, and then we can move to our sort of like – our wonderful new wars and our wonderful new ways of waging it, you know, bringing horridness from the skies. So Iraq, I don't know that there's much to say, but this, it really is the end for us, isn't it?
Well, how depressing do you want me to be?
Oh, come on. Let's see the full Spackerman depression.
We'll go
into full Spackerman depression.
The full depression mode, you know, so go reach for the Zoloft. The U.S. military comes home from Iraq on December 31st. What happens after that? After that, you're going to have the largest diplomatic presence by American diplomats of anywhere in the world. And who protects them? Who protects them is an army basically contracted out, a hired army of around 5,500, maybe 5,000 armed security contractors. And we have no idea what their rules of engagement are. We have no idea what kind of oversight is going to be placed on them by a division of the State Department that's really placed very poor oversight over them for the last several years. And we also know that the State Department has absolutely no experience running a military organization the size of a heavy combat brigade. So that's what comes next in Iraq. The U.S. military goes home, the hired military comes in.
And is the reason why we have the largest diplomatic corps of any in Iraq simply inertia at this point? I mean, you know, like
– no.
All right. Well, then what is it? I mean, it seems – I mean, is Iraq really – I mean, do we have that much diplomacy to do in Iraq per se?
No, it's a signal of a political commitment that the U.S. isn't basically just leaving it to fend for itself. On January 1st. And one of the reasons it's doing that is basically as a way to help sell the end of the shooting war that, like, okay, at least, you know, we're going to bring all the troops home, but, you know, we're not going to, you know, have a bug out or let this place, fend for itself. We're going to have, diplomatic and economic relationship with the Iraqis. We're going to help lend, you know, some aid to them. on training their military with a very, 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 very small contingent of uniformed military troops. But we're not just out the door. So it's kind of like the politics of this thing are such that, or at least the way they've been for the last year or so, is that, you know, as you know, you want the troops to all come home. Well, that means the diplomats are going to kind of get a bigger presence. And what no one's really talking about, there's going to be this 5,000 or so contingent of armed security contractors that also kind of helps mitigate that drawdown.
So, I mean, it is conceivable, based upon the fact that this is sort of unprecedented, at least in American history, that this mercenary squad that is sort of like the, I guess, the State Department's private army, theoretically, right, they could be sent out to, I don't know, on some type of exercises, on to function. Is there any
doubtful
parameters?
That's pretty doubtful. The contracts that they're under are to protect diplomats. Now, you can take it, I mean, you don't even have to go really far out from that definition to think about, you know, what that means. You know, there are tons of Iranian operatives. There are tons of still sectarian militia groups in Iraq. According to the Secretary of Defense, there's 1,000 loyalists of al-Qaeda still in Iraq. Any number of them could want to attack a U.S. diplomat. And then at that point, the private contractor that's supposed to protect the diplo from getting from point A to point B opens fire. And then what does that do? That causes a very foreseeable, disastrous breakdown in U.S.-Iraqi relations. Iran rushes in to fill the void. And you can just see how that goes. You don't even have to get to scenarios about, you know, security contractors going on raids to get to, you know, foreseeable problems here.
Is there anything that, I mean, we've talked over the years many times about Iraq. Is there anything now that we're at the end of this stage of our involvement and of our occupation of that country? Is there anything remotely positive? I mean, and I'm talking even in the most cynical perspective that has come out of this. We have killed at least 100,000 plus Iraqis by our own government's measure. The number is probably, several times larger than that. We have displaced at least 2 to 4 million, whether they're outside of the country or inside the country. We have destabilized the region. We have tarnished our reputation in terms of torture. We have injured tens of thousands of U.S. military personnel, killed over 4,000. Is there anything, like, we don't even get to say, like, we sure learned our lesson. It doesn't even seem like we learned a lesson here.
It's exceptionally hard to make a case for the Iraq War and for its benefits. I'll give you one benefit, and I'm not saying it outweighs everything else, but here's one benefit. Al-Qaeda screwed itself over in Iraq much, much more than we did. Al-Qaeda made a massive stand in Western Sunni Iraq to say that we are the vanguards of the faithful, taking a stand against the Americans, and we look out for your interests. And Iraqi Sunnis looked at these people and said F you. They looked at what Al-Qaeda's actual forms of its positive vision were, and it involved people getting their fingers cut off for smoking, people told that they were being insufficiently Muslim and then getting attacked or murdered for it, and on down the line. And Iraqis decided for themselves that they were going to take matters into their own hands and wipe Al-Qaeda out of Anbar province. That's something, and it's something big. Al-Qaeda hasn't recovered from that. Even Al-Qaeda in Iraq hasn't recovered from that. It was a massive, massive repudiation by the people who matter most of what this eschatologically themed conspiracy theorist lunatic outfit actually has to offer. That's something.
Now, but wasn't that, I mean, the alternative, if there is no Iraq war, that you're saying that Al-Qaeda's resources would have gone somewhere else where they may have been more appreciated?
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to make a case for the Iraq war. You asked me if there's anything that, you know, comes out of that, and there is that. You know, you can go down the line with some other, you know, tactical developments, but, you know, let's put that aside.
Right.
If it was in Iraq, you know, who knows what it would have been. Iraq was certainly a rallying cry and a recruitment call for al-Qaeda for a long time, but it ended for them sort of proving that as badly counterproductively as the U.S. can behave, al-Qaeda is even stupider.
Right. And all right, so speaking of which, let's now travel a little bit north and get to our wonderful program of bringing horridness to people from the skies. Wired magazine posted about, I think it was a dozen photographs that were purportedly, and yep, all the qualifications were there, of the implications on the ground of our drone attacks. Tell us about our drone program and tell us the implications of Pakistan pushing the CIA out of their sort of drone, number one drone base, I guess, in Western Pakistan.
Yeah, on the piece that I did yesterday for Wired on this, I got my hands on a number of photographs taken in North Waziristan, which is where the drone war operates and which is pretty much the epicenter of global terrorism at this point. And this place is a complete black box. It's off limits to outsiders. It's exceptionally dangerous for the people who are caught in the crossfire who live in North Waziristan. And we just don't know even what it looks like. You know, how many pictures from, you know, tribal Pakistan have you seen? How many pictures from Miran Shah have you seen? You haven't seen any of them. Or you've seen exceptionally, exceptionally little and only what governments have wanted you to see, pretty much. We thought it was important after doing over a month's worth of due diligence to verify the information on these photographs and the person who took them and provided them to me, that we at least get some kind of light shown on a secret war's battlefield. And so that's what we did yesterday. On the question about the CIA getting kicked out of an air base in Pakistan, that's a place called Shamsi that we've known about for about two odd years now, that the CIA has flown its drone program over North Waziristan and over tribal Pakistan from. CIA is out of that because of Pakistani anger at 2 weeks ago, a U.S. helicopter disaster that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. The thing is that it doesn't stop the drone war. It just moves it to bases inside Afghanistan, which will wage it from there. And Pakistan hasn't denied the U.S. overflight rights over Pakistan, which is something that actually would complicate or, you know, if not actually stop the drone war. I'm not sure if it would actually stop it, but it would certainly complicate it. And they haven't taken that step. So there's at least an element where, you know, getting kicked out of this one Pakistani base is a bit of kabuki.
So, I mean, it seems the Pakistani regime and, you know, the Musharraf regime before it doesn't seem to have too much of a problem with this. I mean, to the extent that it's not a problem for them domestically, they don't have a problem with us doing this, despite the fact that we're obviously, you know, by our own admission, you know, according to like a Frontline report, an anonymous official told the New York Times that the drone program had only killed 50 non-combatants since 2001. I find that slightly hard to believe, but that it's only 50, but it's 50. And never mind what it does to people on the ground who are just like, oh, I'm going to go out and milk my cow and look up in the sky. Is that a bird? No, it could be something that's going to now drop, is going to shoot a little rocket at me or something. But the Pakistani officials don't seem to have a problem with it as long as it doesn't hurt them domestically.
What they have a problem with is it becoming too public. No one in Pakistan, you know, really believes that its government, that their government, you know, opposes the drone program. It's a bit of theater. What they want to do is make sure that the Pakistani government is insulated from its effects domestically, as you point out. Pakistan, you know, probably the best overview you can give, you know, in a bumper sticker, is schizophrenic about terrorism and about its cooperation with the U.S. alike. It gets a ton of money from the United States in both military and civilian aid and doesn't want to jeopardize that. At the same time, it doesn't want to make a decisive split with terrorists either, because it uses them as a tool of its foreign policy. To bring this full circle, the defense bill that you started out talking about freezes Pakistani military aid until there's a better sense of Pakistan being less schizophrenic, shall we say, about its relationship with both the U.S. and with terrorist groups.
So when we kill your people,
I think it's something like 700 million.
When you kill when we kill your people, you better be a little bit more grateful, or we're not going to keep paying you. That's basically the message.
I guess. I mean, it's definitely a message saying, like, if you're going to take our money, there's a classic Biggie Smalls song about this that I don't, with R. Kelly on the chorus, that I don't believe I can sing on a family program like yours. But it involves a certain kind of transactional relationship. And that's kind of in reality what the United States has with Pakistan and how it wants Pakistan to understand that relationship.
Spencer Ackerman, it is always, always a pleasure and always cheery. I love to, Spencer comes on the show and tells us, recaps Iraq, a horrible period chapter in our existence, and then talks about how the military will be able to round us up in no time at all, just by a unilateral decision that we are terrorists, of course, which is, I guess, better than getting unilaterally assassinated. Because we are someone decides that we're terrorists. And then, of course, it reminds us that at least we don't live in Pakistan, where we could have shining birds flying over us and blowing us up. But it's only a matter of time, right? I mean, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Is that the way it goes?
Find that silver lining, Sam.
That's right. We're going to get our own
drones. Find that silver lining. I support you.
Flying over us soon anyways. Thank you, Spencer Ackerman. I appreciate it. All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ian from Occupy Baltimore. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling. Forget what it was. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ian from Occupy Baltimore. Welcome to the program, Ian.
That's different.
We're going to have a tough connection with you, so let's try and do this. So I understand you guys got evicted last night.
Yep.
I'm sorry, Ian. We can't hear you, buddy. Cell phone reception,
okay,
not so good. We try now.
There, I'm heading outside. How do I sound now?
You sound much better now.
Okay, great. So we had about 150 police officers in riot gear come down to McClellan Square. I actually wasn't there. I was at home. Because I have class on Mondays, but got in touch with some people, and it turns out that the police blockaded probably like a 6-block radius around the park.
Wow.
And sent in 150 police officers in riot gear. There were no arrests. They actually were, everything was really peaceful. So there's that. And all of our stuff is at the city dump, and they said people could come and pick it up if they want, otherwise it's getting thrown away.
And so what happens, what happens now?
So we are currently kind of in the post-removal planning stages. There was an emergency GA 2 hours ago that I couldn't be at because I was at work, but I got in touch with people who were there, and we are going to have a general assembly in front of City Hall tomorrow, or tonight at 8 p.m.
And any sense of what the next move is for you guys?
Well, I think that largely it's just going to be about putting more emphasis on the other projects that we're working on, and then maybe some sort of neighborhood occupations that if people feel that, you know, it's time for that. We've been kind of bouncing these ideas around for a while now. There's a lot of parks and, you know, kind of unused areas in Baltimore that we could take over in individual neighborhoods. That would be a good way to draw attention to kind of the neglect that the city has allowed to occur. And then we're also already at, we already have a foreclosure working group who's working on some planned actions there that I'm a part of. And yeah, I mean, we're going to be totally working on all of the things that we were already working on. And you know, if we lose the central location, really all we lose is, you know, kind of the visibility, which is unfortunate, but I don't think that it's, you know, I don't think that it's a killing wound, so to speak.
Was this an announced raid or was it a surprise? I mean, did you guys know that
it
this was coming?
Complete surprise. They didn't tell us, they gave us 15 minutes to clear out and they didn't give us any other advance warning.
Wow. So getting back to the future, I imagine that there's quite a bit of foreclosures for you guys to deal with down there as well.
Yeah. We've already been contacted by a few people who are interested in potentially doing some eviction defense. We're looking at maybe doing some auction disruption. You know, we're actually kind of in the planning stages of some actions now. So we will see kind of what we get done before the end of the year. We're planning on at least doing a few actions before January. So we'll see what we can get done.
Well, fantastic. Well, Ian, I appreciate your talking to us about this, and keep us updated on the actions that you guys are taking.
Will do, will do. And our rendition of A Christmas Carol is still coming along, so hopefully I'll get a tape of that.
All right, great. Well, make sure you send it this way.
Definitely will do. All right.
All right, appreciate it, Ian.
Yep.
All right, folks.
Thanks.
That is the first half of the show, anyways, today. Now we will go into the better half of the program. Well, I could tell a little story about Cone. What's that? Yeah. Thank you, man. Folks, we are asking you, our listeners, to come onto our blog at majority.fm. We will have a post up shortly to name your top three interviews. And if you want, you can substitute a segment of the past year. Maybe, you know what, let's just go back for the past year. It doesn't even have to be 2011. It's going to be 1 year. Because we're going to do one or two best ofs at the end of the year. And we want to know what interviews you get to vote for three. Don't vote for more than three. If you vote for more than three, you will not, we're not even going to look at your post. So just log on and don't have a huge explanation as to why. Just name them. Like, for instance, Spencer Ackerman, the first time he came on to depress us, not the second time he came on to depress us. Or, you know, say the date if possible.
Yeah, for people who are regulars on the program, definitely leave a date because they've been on so many times.
Right. And
don't put Cliff Schechter.
Yes, don't just write Cliff Schechter. That would be difficult. You can say, like, Cliff Schechter on this day because of why, because, you know, it's a long interview. But And that will be open for at least the rest, just until like probably Friday night, because we need to start to collect those. So help us design our best of. We'll only do like one or two best ofs, because we always give you fresh content. And whether you're in Germany or Mexico or Egypt or Canada or America, we could use your membership at majority.fm to support the program.
You know, a great way to pick a best of is think of interviews that you'd want newer listeners to hear that they might not have heard, or it's too far back for them to even find.
And late breaking, it turns out Tobias from Köln is not a member. Oy. All right, folks. All right, we will see you in the better half of the show. Number 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM.